I think we all realize that study of any subject by means of that instrument, which is itself the subject of the study, presents certain very definite difficulties. The mind of man is able to distinguish many things, but has never yet been adequately able to distinguish its own essence. Man has greater trouble understanding himself than he has in seeking out the answers to other questions. Always, therefore, when the individual turns upon the source of his own faculties in an effort to discover their meaning or their substance, he must use these faculties to explain themselves. And this, mostly, cannot be, for the reason that faculties have a kind of motion. And that motion is from themselves toward other things. To reverse this motion and turn the faculty toward itself represents a very difficult and, for the most part, unsuccessful venture. Therefore, when we come to the problem of consciousness, we are seeking to understand a power or energy that we commonly use, that is available to all of us, that has become a familiar part of our own existence. If there be a consciousness separate from this kind of consciousness, and we assume that there may be, then this also is difficult for us to understand. For we are conscious of consciousness only as we experience it. And by this experience, we discover it as an energy or power by which we may know certain things, by which we may motivate certain actions, by which we may comprehend or conceive on the level of idea. Consciousness has something to do with memory, something to do with thought, a great deal to do with understanding. Yet although we have coined terms for all these functions of a luminous energy within ourselves, we have no adequate means of discovering the substance and nature of that energy. We assume that at death, the individual is separated in some way from body, or his consciousness ceases to function, and that therefore the state of inanimation, which we call death, would represent the suspension of separation of consciousness from a body. We are not even certain that this is true. But we assume, therefore, that consciousness has to do with animation. And from the word itself, we suspect a relation to the soul or the psychic life of the individual. We like to assume, furthermore, that consciousness is that part of our nature which is most true to ourselves, most near to being our real existence. And by extension, because of its luminous and wonderful power, we further like to assume that consciousness is like God, or that God is manifested as consciousness, and that the consciousness in man is a God power, a divine element or energy available to man in part, available to the universe in its total existence. Thus consciousness we conceive or sense as being a vast area of self-knowing, a vast area of energy by which things become aware of themselves and of each other, by means of which the knower or the conscious being becomes aware of nature and of the universe and of the infinite diversity of manifestation going on constantly in the world around us. Studying this term of consciousness, however, we come upon a number of other elements or factors which have to be considered. Assume, for example, that consciousness is universally diffused through all things. Yet in this universal diffusion of their superior part, all things are not equal. Therefore, the consciousness in the plant is in some way different from the consciousness in man. The consciousness in the atom is different from that of the consciousness in the animal. Thus, consciousness, though infinitely diffused, is not in some way infinitely equal in manifestation. If consciousness is a reality, is a total life principle, if all things participate in it, we should then wonder why all things are not the same, and how it happens that the consciousness of one individual comes to different conclusions about many problems, or faces life in a different way from the consciousness in another individual. We must come to the conclusion, therefore, that there is not only something universal about consciousness, but also something particular. That this term, as we use it, perhaps is unwisely or unskillfully applied. It may be that the word consciousness has come to have a meaning that is not inherent in the energy which we are seeking to describe. For certainly, consciousness in different persons leads to different acceptances and rejections. Even if we wish to regard all of these as equal, we must still face the problem of infinite diversity or difference. Therefore, consciousness is composed of an infinite number of different aspects of itself. This presents a very difficult situation again to rationalize. We might assume that if consciousness is the divine life in man, that as man unfolds, he would come to certain common agreements, that he would have certain common consciousness experiences. To a measure he has, but not to a sufficient degree to fully justify our acceptance of our own definition. We may assume, or should be able to assume, that a number of persons, all of about the same degree of social, racial, cultural background, should have comparatively identical points of view. This they do not. We might also assume that genius, or the development of hyper-individuality, would lead to some penetration into common consciousness. This is not true in most cases. In fact, we begin to recognize the importance of the individual, the individual being a separate point of view, and that perhaps we need individuals more than we have suspected. And what we call conformity, in which we all come to common conclusions, may not be as desirable or as much a symbol of advancement as we have generally supposed. Thus we have this one life in us, this thing which we call consciousness, producing an infinite diversity of personal equations, each one distinctly separate, each one in some mysterious way an individual, And we discover that if consciousness is universal in one aspect, it is utterly individual in another. And that consciousness is a universality of individuals or individualities. And that wherever we turn, we find forms of life unfolding consciousness according to needs, according to attributes. The Greeks took up this problem and came to the conclusion that difference was not a matter of consciousness, but of psychic emphasis. According to them, man's consciousness differed because of the vessel which contained it. The individual's personality, his body, his emotions, his lower mental equipment, these were the differentiating factors. And one consciousness, moving into an infinite variety of personalities, became interpreted or defined according to these individualities rather than according to its own nature. Therefore, it was the mind that made the individual, not his consciousness. And the concept of the Greek was that what we term consciousness was universal and mind was individual. Thus, as man's body is personal, separate from all other bodies, his mind is individual, capable of an existence independent of other minds. But his life is not individual. His life is universal, utterly dependent upon one source of life. And to the ancients, this life and life source were the fountains of consciousness. For to them, consciousness was life itself. Assuming this as a tenable idea, we must still, however, face certain confusion. Because actually, life or consciousness is a power superior to mind. It seems strange, therefore, that mind can mold consciousness, can limit it, restrict it, or prevent its proper expression, or can cause it to come to error. Whereas it might be more reasonable to assume that consciousness would be ever modifying mind, and that consciousness itself, being stronger and more universal than mind, would early in evolution achieve a conquest of consciousness over intellect, and that therefore man would be constantly under the dominion of his consciousness rather than his thoughts. Yet consciousness and thought are in conflict in many instances. And up to this stage in our evolution, thought has more frequently won than lost. And consciousness has nearly always remained the victim of the intellectual and emotional pressures of the human being. Psychology may say that consciousness is therefore mind and pressure. It is mental, it is emotional, it is all these things. Consciousness is therefore simply an animating principle, capable of being involved in innumerable complexities, and not capable, actually, of dominating any of them, inasmuch as consciousness, as we please to call it, is the product of life rather than the cause of life, and that the education of consciousness is essentially the reason for existence. Now, this viewpoint, of course, is contrary to your older classical opinion. For in your classical system, man as a spiritual or enlightened being had an existence prior to man as a relapsed or benighted creature. Man falling into generation fell from a divine state into a mortal state, by means of which his inner consciousness was obscured. And he became the victim of appetites, pressures, and desires. Liberation, therefore, was the release of consciousness from involvement in desire. It's restoration by discipline, by renunciation, by the gradual separation of man's integrity from the restraint placed upon it by his environmental life. It was nearly always a series of ethical compromises. Here again, consciousness assumes an interesting but rather confused position. Man attempting to restore consciousness finds himself, for example, in the Greek philosophy, in the place of a savior of his own consciousness. Instead of consciousness, which is his divine nature, rescuing him, he must rescue consciousness. He must make a voluntary restoration of it, which would seem to imply that whatever consciousness is, it is not capable of an immediate and instantaneous transformation of anything dissimilar to itself. Man is not thereby directly rescued by consciousness, but must preserve his own integrity and earn the right to possess what we might term enlightened consciousness. Consciousness is therefore recondite. It is hidden. It is something that must be earned. It is a reward. It is something which will not achieve its own immediate freedom, but must be freed by something else. This, again, is quite contrary to the attitude that we commonly have that it is omniscient, that consciousness is absolute and ultimate truth. If consciousness in man existed in a state of natural and eternal truth, how could any lesser part of man exist in a state of delusion or error? It isn't a case of where man has to rescue himself. If consciousness is the total of himself, if it is the mainspring and energy of himself, if it is his over-self, his all-self, and it is true, and it knows, and it is perfection in itself, how can man linger in any other state? Why is he not immediately absorbed into this completeness which is the root and life of himself? If consciousness is deity, and this deity abides in man, why does not this deity fulfill man, bringing man into a state of identity with itself by the very virtue of itself being in man and forever operating there? The medieval scholastics attempted to create an explanation of this, which they formulated under the doctrine of original sin. They conceived that in some way man had set up an interval between himself and deity or consciousness, that man had been disobedient. By disobedience, he had broken away and destroyed the harmony between himself as a creature and the creator whose energy reposed within him. Thus man had to mend this wickedness before he could be restored to the grace of God. This mending was repentance. This mending was a restatement of individual integrity. This mending was the voluntary acceptance of the will of God and the voluntary relinquishment of human will. The circumstances of this original sin differ in many religions, but it is present in several of them. Among the more philosophical systems, the idea of original sin simply gives way to the processes of evolution in which life, absorbing itself into matter, enters into a state of conflict with its environment. And this conflict must continue until the victory of life over matter. But life and matter are thereby in conflict. But even this is difficult for us to understand. For if consciousness is all there is, and is eternal, and is inevitable, and is all-knowing, with what can it be in conflict? How can there be a conflict between complete consciousness and any other state, presuming there can be any other state. For consciousness, being total, would be totally capable of understanding. And can we be in conflict with anything that we totally understand? And philosophy is inclined to question, assuming that nearly all conflict that we can recognize arises from lack of understanding. Also, can we be in conflict with that in which there is no secret or no mystery? Most of our difficulties arise because we do not have a knowledge of the internal lives of other things. We do not experience their true motive. We do not understand the burdens or the responsibilities which influence their actions. If we had such understanding in total, would it not be more likely that we would be sympathetic rather than critical? Therefore, that conflict again would be less and less probable. Also, where consciousness existed, there could be no ignorance, because there could be nothing unknown. And if there is no ignorance, no superstition, no doubt and fear, we would be living in a very different world from the one we now inhabit. Yet consciousness remains as having an existence of some kind. And it has always been assumed that at the root of life, there was an all-pervading omniscience, an all-knowing, an all-being. And that this consciousness was the diviner part, the inner part, the nobler part of creatures. This brings us to our particular problem of the evening, which is to try to estimate a term which has come into some usage, the term the pre-conscious. Here again, we are in a very rarefied atmosphere. But let us try and see what we can do with it. A condition, an energy, or a state must either be always and forever the same, or it must be in a state of eternal flux. Things are forever alike, or they are forever moving from one likeness to another. We go back to our Greeks again. If consciousness is eternal, it is forever the same. If consciousness is not eternal, it is forever different. Those are the rules by means of which it has to function. For a thing which has not a conscious eternity in its nature must move from a previous to a subsequent condition forever, moving forever from what it has been, through what it is, toward what it will be. And if a thing is not always alike or always the same, then what it has been, what it is, and what it will be must always differ. Our rule further tells us that in a universe of orderly procedure, such as we envision to be our own, a motion from a previous to a present to a future condition must always be a progressive motion. Therefore, unless consciousness is omnisciently and omniactively always the same, it is forever moving from a lesser condition of itself toward a greater one. In other words, it is growing. It is either eternal or it is growing. Now, if it is growing, it is in the infinite state of becoming, a becomingness that goes on beyond our ability to conceive or understand. It is difficult for us to assume that a becomingness goes on forever without an achievement of becoming. This is another very difficult thing for us to understand. But our philosophers have pointed out that this state a forever becoming in which the fullness or completeness has not yet been achieved and theoretically may never be achieved, being always a state of becoming, that each now in that, each moment under consideration is a total state of becoming, so that the individual who lives now has very little sense of his own shortcomings. He can conceive of how much less he once was by looking backward, but he cannot look forward. Therefore, he cannot know how much more he will be. That every moment, therefore, man feels intuitively that he is the master of the ages. He is the greatest thing that ever has been at every moment of his destiny. But tomorrow he discovers he can be greater. This situation leaves him comparatively comfortable without the need of a finality upon his own growth. Assuming that consciousness can be a condition of becoming, that it is a state of perpetual and eternal unfoldment of potential, that it is like a stream flowing from an ancient fountain and flowing down through time and eternity until it fulfills its incredible, immeasurable destiny. If such is the situation, then we must assume that at any time, consciousness is the consequence of something and is in turn causing something else as a consequence of itself. Thus the term preconscious is man's effort to discover the nature of the consciousness of yesterday, the consciousness before it is now. The individual trying to work with this experience of the consciousness before it is now runs into an immediate problem, which helps perhaps to clarify the whole issue. The moment he tries to think back as to his consciousness yesterday, he must do it with his consciousness of today. Therefore, he runs into a peculiar dilemma. He cannot be what he was yesterday. He can only contemplate it in the light of what he is today. So he can never fit himself into the consciousness of his own past. Once it is gone, it can be restored by memory, revitalized, but not re-experienced. It is like pain. Once it stops, you cannot feel that particular pain again. But you can certainly remember how much it hurt. But you cannot revitalize the experience of that pain. Even the neurotic person cannot quite make it, although some of them do stupendously well in their effort to recapture it. If, then, we are to re-experience the state, we will say, of ourselves 10, 15, 20 years ago, something has to happen first. And the thing that has to happen first is that the consciousness of ourselves now must be blocked, or we cannot do it. If, therefore, we approach it on the basis of hypnotic regression, putting the now to sleep, refocusing the individual upon a time gone by, and causing him to relive that time, we may cause that individual to reactivate a pattern of consciousness that is dead, that is gone as far as objective awareness is concerned. When we do this, we cause this person who is now the adult to revitalize and completely re-energize the state of their own childhood at a given time. One of the most common being a birthday party of 20 or 30 years earlier. the child can be caused to be again rescued out of the adult, proving that this previous consciousness did not actually die, but was submerged, and is no longer available as itself in the conscious state of the individual. Only when the new consciousness, the consciousness of today, is blocked, can this old consciousness be revitalized. Now, tests have been made of this particular type of regression, and an interesting point has been noted. When you regress an adult, say, to the seventh year, and give them careful psychological testing during the regression, you discover that you cannot regress the child, we will say, to the seventh year. You can revitalize the incident of the seventh year, causing the child to live them. But the child will live even those incidents with a slightly greater maturity than the original 7 years would have justified. So if you regress the child to its seventh year, it will interpret its seventh year experiences with the mind of an eight-year-old child. There will be 1 year additional growth that you cannot block. This is an interesting point, because it means that even in a regression, and even though the conscious mind of today is asleep, there is a certain subconscious growth that cannot be prevented and which continues to accumulate gradually. In the course of 20 or 30 years, the difference of approximately 1 year in the patterns will be noticed. It comes around, however, that the reason why the past is no longer to be normally re-experienced is because the point of awareness has moved away from it. And the point of awareness is normally always contemporary. It is always focused on the now, because it is the association mechanism moving from within the individual which binds him to the present environment, the present consideration, and the testimonies of the present sensory reflexes. By action, man is bound to now, and it is only when in some way he is artificially prevented from continuing his present focus that he enters into a state of pre-focus or pre-consciousness. Now we can also say, supposing that we did block this individual, supposing we block his present consciousness entirely, so that he is not aware that he has any existence whatever, and we give him no directive, we don't tell him anything, we simply give him a non-directive for objective functions. Things heard, seen, known in his daily life are separated from him by a suspension of his external sensory faculties and the suspension of his ego function. If we do this and leave him alone, we will have no report on him whatever. He will not register anything. He will remain in a state of apparently dreamless sleep. And he will remain in that state until he is awakened. If, therefore, we simply block the now, the individual does not automatically fall into any other time pattern. He doesn't fall into yesterday or tomorrow if you simply block now. You block now, he simply falls asleep and stays there. If, however, you block now and regress him you can recapture any part of his life up to the moment. If you block now and attempt to progress him, however, into a future state, you are again blocked. He has not the capacity to achieve a condition not experienced. So one of two things will happen. Either he will still remain asleep, or you must create for him a future. Then you may cause him to visualize it or enter into it. If you wish to define for him some utopian dream that you expect will occur in the future, and you tell him that he is living in a city of gold and that everybody is happy, and give him sufficient directive, he will see and report what you have told him, living in exactly the kind of place you have created for him. But he has no normal instinct to create such a place for himself. Because the moment you have suspended his objective consciousness, you have suspended also his regrets about the way things are or his wish to change them. These are very tricky equations, but they do tell us something if we really want to study them. If then we take away from man his objective awareness, we do not immediately give him subjective awareness. If we block out the consciousness of birth, he is not immediately awakened in heaven. If we take away from him that which is familiar, he simply sleeps, proving apparently that he is bound only to the familiar. And that the moment we depart from that which is experienced by him, or can be experienced by his sensory perceptions, he ceases to function. This brings another interesting equation into the problem. What happens, or what conceivably could happen, if a person under hypnosis could be induced to dream? Now, here would be an interesting problem. Now, he can be induced to dream because the operator can cause him to internally visualize or experience whatever the operator desires or gives in the form of a suggestion. The person will experience these things and report upon them. But of his own accord, he seems less likely to dream than he does in normal sleep. Something has happened in connection with his psychic pressure load, and the psychic pressure load which causes dreaming seems to be suspended by the hypnotic procedure. It is therefore necessary to direct the hypnotized person into some reflection or into some channel of action, subjective action, if you wish him to experience it. Of himself, he will not experience it. Also, when the time comes for this person to reawaken into objectivity, it is possible either to block the side of life which has been under the hypnotic somnambulism so that the patient has no memory of it, or it is possible to leave this gate of memory open so that the individual will remember. This becomes a matter of decision and presents another interesting phase, namely that whereas in ordinary dreams, the natural tendency is for the dream to fade away in the objective state of awakening, except in a very few extreme cases. In the case of hypnosis, this can be controlled in such a way that the individual's awareness can be directed by the operator into memory or lack of memory, as seems to be most desirable. In analytical words, sometimes lack of memory is very important, because otherwise the person is too rapidly burdened with too much of an unloading of his own psychic nature, which has to be carefully avoided. Now, what has all this to do with the problem of consciousness in one? It has this to do with it. Namely, that the sleep center, when it is controlled, or the individual is caused to enter into the voluntary state of unconsciousness, actually is no longer aware of any objective circumstances going on around him, nor is he aware of his own actions during hypnosis except by permission of the operator. But now we have this point. He can be caused to remember or not. Therefore, actually, we have this situation. Supposing a person under hypnosis is told not to remember. 5 years later, the person is placed again under hypnosis, and under the hypnotic condition is permitted to remember while again hypnotized. He will remember. This can then be again blocked before awakening, so that the individual ultimately can, at discretion, prove that they have two systems of memory operating simultaneously and completely separate from each other, so that a continuity can be set up, either in the state of hypnosis or outside of the state of hypnosis, and these two memories will carry on and never meet, unless the operator wishes them to meet. Yet he can bring them together at any time he wishes. Under such conditions, it is evident that in hypnosis, that there is a kind of consciousness that will carry on from one experience to another. Therefore, that man potentially has more than one memory system, a subjective or subconscious memory system and a conscious memory system. And both of these systems are not only operating during hypnotic problems, but are constantly operating in the normal so-called experiences of life and still do not meet. But man has, therefore, sleep memory and waking memory. He has a kind of memory which records psychic pressure night after night through dreaming, without that pressure ever being faithfully reported objectively, so that this psychic pressure can be a cause of reflection, thoughtfulness, fear, doubt, worry, for a lifetime without ever coming through into the consciousness of the individual as a conscious memory. It means, of course, that under such conditions, ventilation of this psychic pressure is usually in sleep in the form of dreams. And these dreams can be consistent for a lifetime without the waking person being aware of the continuity of their meaning or the pressures which they are seeking to release. Yet these dreams themselves indicate a complete subjective continuity and a deep laid plan that is going to fulfill itself in some way. Free consciousness, therefore, implies several things. It implies the problem of the emerging of the conscious life of man at birth. It implies the problem of the re-emergence of the conscious life of man from sleep daily. It also has a larger universal implication in the emergence of the consciousness which we call man from a pre-conscious state in nature. Furthermore, it challenges us with the fact that man is a manifestation of some kind of an energy that is everywhere resident in space, and therefore that the pre-conscious state of man probably must correspond with a universal space, which still surrounds man, and also affects the numerous creatures around him in nature. All of these points lead then to this consideration, that consciousness as we know it is a condition, a state, a degree in the unfolding of something. And that this thing that is unfolding emerged from a previous state, which was the seed or root of itself. And that this previous state may or may not clearly resemble or be recognizable in the terms of the condition which emerged from it. Thus, for example, if man saw only an oak tree and was never aware of where the oak tree came from, and never saw the growth of an oak tree, there would be no rational procedure in the world that could convince him that it began with an acorn. It simply would be impossible if man himself did not know through experience and observation that such is the case. Because the acorn is not in a way understandable or acceptable as the source of a great tree many thousands of times the size of itself. Also, therefore, in terms of consciousness, that which is pre-conscious may in no way resemble consciousness as we know it, and yet may be capable of containing it, engendering it, causing it to emerge from itself. Also, is consciousness itself fruitful? Does it in turn bear a kind of fruit, by means of which other forms of knowing or being or existing may be engendered or caused to come into manifestation? Some of your Eastern philosophies assume that the entire universe is composed of nothing except conditions of consciousness, that there is no such a thing as consciousness and something else, that there is only consciousness, that matter is a kind of consciousness, that mind is a kind of consciousness, that stars and elements are kinds of consciousness, and that actually that this one energy in its infinite manifestation is all that exists, and all things are modes of it in varying degrees of the unfoldment of one of eternal essence. These Indians, of course, then also take the ground that space itself, which is the great field of consciousness potential, consciousness in its most abstract form, has within it an infinite seed life of its own nature, and that these seeds are forever growing, bursting into life, germinating, so that there is an eternal harvest of creation existing forever, rising from the substance of the uncreated self. That everywhere in nature, consciousness is blooming from its own root, blossoming forth and bearing its fruit. And as Plotinus explained it, it was a kind of mysterious flower with its root in heaven and its branches downward and its blossoms in the experience of man. This type of thinking perhaps supports the idea also that consciousness is a mystery which must forever be the quest of man until it is explained. That finally, existence has as its primary objective the solving of the mystery of consciousness. That all things that happen are indicative in some way of the great riddle or its solution. That man's completeness, that man's journey ends only with the solution to the mystery of consciousness. If such may be considered a possibility, we are now dealing more or less with a valid school of thought in the Far East. What then is the ethical implication? What is the discipline involved in this thinking? The discipline involved is the effort of the individual to have the experience of pure consciousness, whatever it may be, that it exists, that the only possible way in which man can solve the mystery of his own existence is to solve it with pure consciousness. And that the only answer to all things rests in the consciousness which causes these things. Unfortunately, however, this is not quite as easy or obvious as might first appear. As far as we are able to observe in nature, most things that happen occur without the causes of themselves being obvious. Man is not aware of the reason for himself, even as he causes his own kind to exist. And we are not so positive or not so certain that any creature, by the mere will or desire, can solve the mystery of its own causation. Nor can we be certain that any creature is fully and completely aware of the reason for itself. The Greeks, again, were of the opinion that the reason for creatures must always be deposited in superior creatures. That it is only in the divine nature that the reason for man exists. And therefore that man cannot solve his own mystery. That all he can do is to seek a reunion with the divine nature in which all mysteries are solved. Other systems of thought, for instance your Vedanta system, approaches the subject of total consciousness with another kind of attitude. And in this we can also find some justification for the Buddhist idea of nirvana. At first thought, the individual attempting to establish pure consciousness or unite himself with pure consciousness is simply casting himself into oblivion. In the Eastern concept, the individual must completely cease to be in order for universal consciousness to be restored to its own eternal rulership over things. There was a conflict between mortal mind and divine mind. And in this conflict, mortal mind must voluntarily surrender itself. And in the voluntary surrender of itself, must sacrifice all of its own objectives, including its own sense of self-awareness. Thus, Western writers, trying to make commentaries upon these Eastern religious classics, have scratched their heads a bit and have come to the conclusion that these old systems are Asiatic nihilism, that they are simply the complete extinction of the individual, that the only peace that man can know is by ceasing to exist totally. This is not actually the concept of the Eastern thinker, however. The Western man, it probably would be the likely explanation. Western man, to whom motion and action are extremely dear, could not conceive of the suspension of his personal desires and attitudes in anything remaining. In the East, however, it is an entirely different perspective. In the East, the idea pertains that it is possible for the individual to completely overcome that interval of not-likeness, by means of which things are separated from other things. That man, dropping into the abyss of his own internal, rejecting by degrees every testimony and function of his sensory perception, detaching himself from every object of mental or emotional life, may finally fall into a complete suspension of the element of illusion in his own nature. Having reached the point, therefore, where everything that is not so has ceased, he stands presumably upon the threshold of that which is so. Then makes another interesting discovery. In his vocabulary, in his thinking, in his mentation, he has never yet devised any means of communicating the nature of that which is so. He has wonderful ways of explaining what is not so. We can share our ignorance with gallantry and ease. In fact, we preach it continuously to each other. We can also have the most learned discourse upon trivia at any moment. We can go on and on, elaborating upon our mistakes, our shortcomings, and our weaknesses. We can spend a great deal of time deciding what is not true. But when it comes to a positive statement of that which is unconditionably true, we have nothing to say, because we have no word, no thought, no idea with which we can grasp it. We have lived always in a kind of dream, a kind of nightmare. In the course of ages, this dream world of our objective senses has become the reality. We have grown so accustomed to war that the one thing we can't define is peace. We can't really experience it because we do not know what it is. We have great difficulty even in trying to explain a little personal peace. It's very hard. To us, peace is merely the least degree of stress. But the total absence of stress, the total positivity of complete peace, is beyond us. And when many people think of it, they think of it only as inertia and total boredom. We have no positive concept of these things. So if in the Buddhist thinking we come finally to the total suspension of everything that is not real, including that part of ourselves which is not real, which Buddha says is the sense of selfhood, what remains? How shall we define what is left? How shall we explain immortality? How shall we assume the state of man after death? In what way shall we explain anything? The Egyptians pointed out that the state of man after death is due largely to the intensities of his condition during life here. The Tibetan in his bardo, or the ritual of death, helps or seeks to help the deceased person to orient himself in another world which is startlingly like this one, or to help him to find an immediate and fortunate re-embodiment back again into this objective world of condition that we know. What would we do with the problem of trying to define a kind of world, a paradise, a heaven, or an inferno, in which a group of absolutely desireless beings continued forever? We just cannot imagine it. We have already populated the other world with all kinds of incidents and personalities and conditions and circumstances derived from here. Apart from what we objectively and subjectively experience, we have no answer.